Why are we doing this campaign? What do we want to happen as a result? In this episode of The Lead Creative, I explore these and many other questions as I speak to Jillian Wrightford, MD of Ed Therapy, Executive Director of the Association for Communication and Advertising, and the lead for Effie Awards South Africa. We unpack why effective work still eludes many brands, not because there's a lack of data, but because, as Jillian puts it,
we're doing too much, too often, with too little budget. Resources are scarce. We're losing talent out of the industry. We're not producing quality because we're not allowing the time for it. And ultimately, we're not really thinking carefully around, why are we doing this? Are we doing it because we did it last year? Are we doing it because our competitors are doing it? Really drilling down into the kind of, what is the role of the brand? How does it show up? And why should anyone care?
She also shares lessons from Red Bull, Prime, and Liquid Death. We explore why distinctiveness, not hype, helps brands stick. We talk about Prof. Byron Sharpe's theories and why creativity and culture still matter. For more insights on what influences marketing and advertising, subscribe to The Lead Creative wherever you're listening to this episode. And also, please leave us a comment or a review. It really helps. Welcome to The Lead Creative Podcast, where we talk to creative industry leaders, influencers, and brands. We discuss the strategies that influence brand thinking and shape industries. Thought leaders and heads of agencies let us in on some of their thinking and insights. I'm your host, Mongezi Mthathi. Enjoy the show, and please share and subscribe. Jillian, thank you for making the time to share your insights with us on The Lead Creative. I think the first thing I'd sort of like to start with is that you had a career in that spans leadership, marketing, strategy, executive education, and of course now leading the Effie Awards. If you could distill one thing that the industry still struggles with all the knowledge that we have, what would that one thing be?
That is a very good question. I think the one thing would be interrogating why we're doing things. I think that we chase after things, but I remember this from a very long time ago when I was at university, and our research professor said to us that the most important part of any research project was defining the objective. And I kind of feel the same about the ad industry. You know, there's a massive problem with writing briefs, for example.
Yeah.
The biggest single problem with writing briefs is answering the why are we doing this and what do we want to happen as a result. And I see so many briefs where they're 8 objectives, that's just crazy. And so I think that what's happened over the years is that we are chasing our tails. We're doing too much, too often, with too little budget. Resources are scarce. We're losing talent out of the industry. We're not producing quality because we're not allowing the time for it. And ultimately, we're not really thinking carefully around, why are we doing this? Are we doing it because we did it last year? Are we doing it because our competitors are doing it? Really drilling down into the kind of, what is the role of the brand? How does it show up? And why should anyone care? That is the bit that I don't think we do very well.
You mentioned your time at Adversity and, talking about your younger self. What would that younger self be surprised at about where advertising and marketing have gone?
I think I was a bit of a kind of purist when I was at university. I was adamant that I didn't want to work in advertising. I thought it was a bit frivolous. And for me, the strategic component of marketing was far more interesting. I think my younger self would be surprised at how unstrategic a lot of it is, in that it's very tactical. And again, that's why I think people aren't interrogating the why, and that piece is the strategy. But I think also my younger self might be surprised that we've maybe lost our respect and trust in creativity, especially when we've got so much information and so much data that backs up how creativity is such an effective force for business. So I think I kind of be questioning why, because I always was a great lover of creativity in the business, and that has come to be proven as, you know, a dollar multiplier and all that stuff. And yet the quality of our creative is going backwards. Like, why? We've got all the data. Why aren't we doing better? So my younger self would be in the library trying to ponder that.
Interesting. Because it's interesting to me because you also do executive training, right? You also train marketers and sort of advertising people in this space. There's, of course, increased reliance on AI now. What do you see as some of the skills that marketers are calling for, which then affect the agency side and that the agencies are also relying on or growing in terms of the skills that are being required in the industry?
That's a great question, because I think that the really good marketers are understanding that there is this X factor of creativity, and they're understanding that they struggle to get it. So the training that I do most often is helping marketers figure out how to get the best work out of their agencies. That means two things. The briefing component, as I mentioned, is really important. The other thing is, what does good look like? So when we're saying, oh, you need to buy better work, what does that look like? What does it mean? And marketers, if they're in a you know, broad marketing role, they'll be dealing with all sorts of things, you know, the cost of sunflower oil from Ukraine, and, you know, they've got big issues on their plates. Yeah. So the skill in what does good look like, how do I evaluate what is put in front of me, and how do I give feedback in a way that I make it better? That's a key skill. So that's some of the stuff that I do in the workshops. And it's always quite revealing, because the tools and tricks and tips, and obviously from years and years and years of experience, but there's always in the training, there's always a sense of a relief, because marketers are being asked to make big decisions in those meetings that cost multiple millions in some instances, and it's not a comfortable space for them. So there's often a sense, I'm so glad I know this now. I wish someone had taught me this earlier.
So one of the things that comes up in these conversations quite a lot from the agency side, especially, in fact, from both sides, agency and brand, is that we, on either side, there's too little time to create the kind of really great work that you constantly ask what good looks like. And on the brand side, there's also very little time to build on the wins of the work that you do with your agency, and you're dealing with many agencies at a time. Some marketers sit in a boardroom and there's maybe four or five different types of agencies, and you need to make decisions that make up the puzzle pieces. How do we balance this to get to this great work and to keep building on it?
Yeah, I think what's very important, I mean, I know, you know, I've done some projects with big brands and agencies, and one of them in particular, they had 17 agencies in the mix. And integration then just becomes a nightmare for the client. But it also is extremely difficult for the individual agencies, and I'm actually seeing it now with another client, and they've got a collaboration of agencies, let's just call it that. But it's not clearly defined who does what It's not clearly defined where the lead comes from. So back in the day, the structure was always you had a lead agency. That was normally your brand agency. They would come up with a big idea, then that would be filtered off to everybody else, and everybody would play nicely off one idea. It's not that simple anymore because the lead depends on the project. So you know, in some instances, the PR agency might be the lead, or so it needs to be a little bit more fluid than it was, which is great, but it needs to be defined, and there needs to be a way of working between the agencies of filtering things through, who's seeing what briefs, you know. There needs to be a kind of a orchestration of the individual puzzle pieces, as you describe them.
Yeah.
The challenge for agencies is all that takes time. There's ego involved. You sometimes, with different agencies, you're sometimes dealing with different clients within the client organization, and they're not aligned. So, you know, you've got your client marketing person in their silo who isn't necessarily talking to other agencies' client in their silo, and yet they're talking to the same audience with the same brand. So it really is a combined effort. You know, sometimes marketers say, oh, the agencies must sort it out. They must get together and have their meetings and come back to me as one voice. The marketing side of the equation also needs to be integrated. And it needs to be recognized that that is an extra thing that you are putting on agencies. And I've always said it must be remunerated for. So if they're going to have 24 new additional meetings in a month, they need to be paid for it. It can't just come out of their individual fees because you know, that's assuming they're on a retainer. Because it's additional work and it's quite hard work because especially if you don't have a mandate. You know, if you're trying to get the, let's say, social media lead to come on board to a, you know, whatever, and they're like, well, you know, I don't report to you. It can get quite fractious. But I want to just go back to, because you mentioned AI.
Yes.
And obviously AI is a huge issue in the industry right now. Everybody's talking about it. Everybody's going, what does it mean? On the one hand, the plus side is I was at a seminar that the ACA actually arranged, our future industry tribe put together on AI and advertising. And one of the WPP speakers was saying that they've looked at tasks on a high empathy, low empathy axis to say low empathy tasks, give it to the robot, you know. And a lot of agencies are developing their own AI tools. They're teaching their own AI so that they can develop and do work the way they want to, not the way that everybody does. So that's exciting. And I do think that there's a great book called Madison Avenue Manslaughter by Michael Farmer. And he is a consultant that looks at the workflow and output of agencies. And he goes, it's no wonder none of them make any money. Well, they do make money, but sometimes it's a struggle for margins. But he says the output of the average creative person has gone up by something like it was 125 times. I think it's even more. So that creative person is having to do multiple iterations of things that are fiddly and not particularly fulfilling from a creative perspective. So that is brilliant for AI. Resize it, you know, change it, put different backgrounds on it. Happy days, off you go. Which should, in theory, free up creative, strategic thinking time. The challenge then, though, is that a lot of agencies have made money out of that. And the marketers are saying now, well, okay, that's been done by the robot. I need a 40% reduction in my fee.
Yes, that so I has think been there's going to be topic, some.
There's going to be some rearrangement of what gets done where by who. And to go back to my beginning point, is I still think we're doing too much. So, you know, it's all faring well to say get AI to resize, redo, you know, always on a million channels. I still question whether we need all of that. But yeah, AI is going to fundamentally change. My biggest concern with AI in the industry is I think it's going to obliterate junior jobs. Mm-hmm. Because you don't need a junior digital copywriter, do you? I don't know. But if you have no junior jobs, you're not going to have any seniors.
This is true.
In 5 years' time.
This is true.
So the biggest takeout of that seminar that we ran was actually AI is not going to take your job, but someone who knows how to use it will.
Interesting.
So I think for you know, I get asked sometimes to have a look at curriculum at various teaching places in the ad world. And one of them was a design school. And I said to them, I think it was the last day, I said, do you have a module on AI? Mm. And they said, no. And I said, well, I think you should. And they said, but what would we put in it? And I said, well, two things. One, which are the best AI tools a designer needs to know and use? How do you use them? But also, you know, what are the aspects of your job that AI is going to take away? They need to know.
If you're enjoying The Lead Creative, please share this episode with your network and hit follow or subscribe. Enjoy the show.
You've said a lot about AI and a lot about the agency side of it. And I appreciate that because this conversation is constantly evolving. There's something else that you said in there, which I think leads us a bit more into this topic of effectiveness. And the thing you said was the siloed nature of brands and marketers within a brand. And some of these, the bigger the brand, the more, you know, marketers within divisions you have. And something that stands out for me there is the risk to the brand, the risk to the brand, which sometimes a brand looks at from a competitor perspective as though it's other brands that they're competing with, as opposed to their own brand voice because of the siloed nature of the brand itself. What are your thoughts on that? What have you seen where that's concerned, and what are the risks concerned there?
Yeah, it's a really good way of putting it, that the brand is actually competing with itself. I've seen it a number of times. It happens in big financial service companies. It happens in telcos where they just tend to be very siloed. And because with a lot of them actually are separate business units. They're not even just a department. They actually have their own managing director. They're a completely separate business. And they'll have their own targets. They have their own KPIs. They have their own P&Ls. So the marketing person in that business unit is only focused on their brand, whether it's insurance or health or you know, that's their brand. They find it very difficult sometimes, and they're quite resistant often to the one brand because they feel it takes their power away. What it actually does is give them more power. And very often in these sort of federal structures, you've got a head of marketing who somehow has to kind of corral all these people in and constantly sell them the benefit of the brand.
Yeah.
As opposed to the division. I think sadly a lot of managing directors and CEOs and those kind of businesses don't understand marketing. I think in many businesses like that, marketing is not very well respected. I mean, it's well researched around the world that there's a CEO and CMO disconnect where they don't speak the same language. So there is a sense that marketing often internally is fighting for its life, really. Mm. It's fighting for relevance and it's fighting for support. It was a very interesting study just published by Marketing Week in the UK. They did a career and salary survey. And it's quite sad to read it. It's quite gloomy. I mean, these marketers are overwhelmed. They're depressed. They are They feel irrelevant. They feel ignored. Now, these are the clients that advertising agencies are going to say, please come with me and take this risk.
Yes.
Risk. Creative isn't risky. But take this risk with me. Come on, it's going to be great. Meanwhile, you know, they're in the trenches. So I think that it's always good for agencies to understand the internal environment that their marketing clients are having to navigate. And one of the workshops I do, I spend the upfront section on saying these are the key issues that marketers are dealing with. And here's how you as an agency can partner with them and help them. You know, how do you raise the profile of marketing in the business so that the naysayers, the non-marketing believers, actually get on board? And when that happens, you see an incredible shift in the dynamics of the business. I've seen it, for example, say with Nedbank. You know, Ken Sahni as the CMO and Mike Brown was the CEO. He's left now. But they spoke often. They spoke about this stuff and they developed a trust-based partnership. And what it allowed Ken Sahni to do as CMO was go and do great work for Nedbank. Yeah. You know, gave her the freedom to do it. But it also worked for the business. And that's obviously what everyone should aim for.
Let's now switch to effectiveness and how that aids effectiveness and grows this effectiveness. I mean, in our conversation before the recording, you spoke about effectiveness and effectiveness moving from no longer from the why to how and now largely to culture. What's the common reason that brands still don't consistently produce effective work? What are some of these reasons that you see or causes that lead to ineffective work or work that isn't as effective as it can be?
I think there are many reasons. There was some good work done by James Herman and the Cannes Lions team on sort of barriers to effectiveness. I think internal culture gets in the way. So Walk has done a lot of, kind of has gone off on a culture of effectiveness tangent. And if he has also published some stuff around culture of effectiveness. You can't, as a marketer, push for great work that will be more effective if your internal company culture doesn't allow you to. So the culture of effectiveness is a thing. And there are ways in which businesses can – it's a behavior change thing. And there are ways in which businesses can allow their people to have more freedom to be able to do that work. But very often it gets bombed at a sort of senior level. And so I would say the culture of effectiveness within the business is very important. One of the things that actually affects effectiveness, bizarrely, is not investing enough in it. So and again, to me, it's doing too much with too little.
Yeah.
So taking a budget and spreading it very, very thinly between a million channels just doesn't give the anchor of the work enough investment to actually make a difference. So. There's some nice. I think there's actually a calculator that they've done, the creative effectiveness people, the ladder people, where you can actually say, have I actually invested enough behind this? And you know, I think that's a big issue. I think again, just knowing what good looks like and trusting it. I don't think that enough marketers spend enough time upskilling in this area. I think it's an area that makes them feel uncomfortable, but I don't think they spend a lot of time going, what is good? You know, gosh, like, let me really unpack this. So it's an enabling culture internally, and it's the skill set, and then it's putting enough money behind it.
There's been a lot of talk about brands wanting more immediate results, more short-term results, which of course affects long-term brand resilience. What changes have you seen over the years within the space of the long versus the short, and how can marketers avoid this short-term trap? Because I think with over-indexing on performance and performance marketing, we are doing quite a lot now in terms of this short-term piece. How can we avoid that so that the brands that are resilient today still become still resilient in 10, 15, 20 years?
Discipline. I think a big part of it is that relationship internally, that CFO, CMO, CEO relationship. We used to call it quarteritis. You know, the people are chasing their quarterly results.
Yes.
And so, you know, we're not going to make our quarterly results on leads, and that's going to be a disaster because we have to report that. So quick, pull some money from here, put it in here, bang that out, off we go. I think that if there's a trust from the business leadership of the company, so the CEO, CFO, if there's a trust that not all campaigns will deliver results immediately, then that conversation and that discipline is easier to hold. It's when there isn't that trust. And again, you know, we have such a wealth of resources available to us around the work that's been done by the LinkedIn Institute, which shows that, you know, at any given time, only 5% of your market is actually actively buying. I think that's for B2B. But for consumers, it's also sort of similar. But it's the point is that the vast majority of people who are going to buy your product are not going to buy it today. So what are we doing? They might only buy it next year. So that understanding that not all campaigns will have an immediate return is really important. And it's not rocket science. But then the marketing team and their advisors need to hold firm that we need to continue to build long term. I think one of the things that's changed, which has actually been a positive, is that there was this sort of theory that, you know, you can't build a brand on digital. I think that that's been dismissed now. So when we say, the thinking was that, oh, okay, like you can't actually go and do brand building work if you are, say, on programmatic. You can, but there are ways of doing it, and there are ways of continuing the brand story, but in a more immediate way. So I think people are getting smarter at it. But it takes discipline to hold that line and not be swayed.
So on this discipline piece that you talk about, you also mentioned, of course, this idea that we're all chasing our quarterly results and our annual results and whatever. So one thing that sometimes I suppose is a pain for agencies and marketers alike is that on the one hand, your agency has has X period that it's been appointed for, and the marketer has been in this position for however long, and they have to report annually. How do we balance these two parts while maintaining this discipline? Because you want the brand, whatever brand, to still be there, but you also want to contribute as a marketer while you're there, and you have to push your agencies to do so, but which then leads us into the space of short-term work. How do we balance it? Mm-hmm. How do we balance these levers with discipline being sort of the core of it or the center of it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know what the current status is, but at one stage, I think it's actually improved. At one stage, the average tenure of a CMO was 18 months. I think it's now about 3 years. But the thing is, as you say, the marketer is only a custodian of the brand. And that brand will be there for long after the marketer has gone on to several other jobs. I think good marketers understand that, and they know that their role is to nurture it through the period that they have it under their care, so to speak. But there is a sense of, you know, let me kind of, you know, stamp my mark on this, and I think one of the things that makes it real is looking at things like brand valuations. So if you take it outside of the advertising space and then you go to somebody like a brand finance, for example, and they look at the value of the brand and you look at the questions that they or Interbrand ask around how they do a brand valuation. And a lot of it is around consistency, and a lot of it is around consumers' understanding of what that brand actually represents. Now, those things have a tangible value on the balance sheet. So then the CEO gets interested because, like, oh, our brand's worth 70 million. Woo! And it can be sold. It's an asset. So then it starts getting real in that this thing that you're playing with actually has tangible value. It was actually an intangible asset, but never mind. It has value. So, like, just to come on and change the packaging, change the thing, change the payoff line, change the pricing structure, whatever, you're actually breaking something that has real value to the business, and that's not your job. Your job is to build it. So I think agencies are sometimes also partially at fault. New agencies that might win a pitch, for example, might suggest a complete departure. Most of the good ones won't. They'll suggest a build. But agencies also get bored with their own work. So they'll have a very, very successful campaign and they'll start getting bored with it. Somebody will say, we've done that. No more ideas in that area. And they'll dump it and they'll carry on. And then you look at hugely successful campaigns. You know, like Johnny Walker, or whatever, that have literally been running, Nike, have been running off the same idea for 30 years. And it's constantly being innovated against, but it fundamentally doesn't change. And I think both agencies and clients throw away work too quickly.
So I'm glad you mentioned the brands that you mentioned, because there's an example that kind of, you know, that's been used recently. The example of Prime, the energy drink. So if you were in the energy drink space and this new brand comes to the scene, seemingly changing things, of course you don't see what the future looks like. So your client would pressure you to go, hey, these guys are doing this, competing with us, and we kind of have to shift things, not knowing that this brand in 6 months or a year wouldn't be anything to talk to, that anyone is talking about. How do you stand firm, firstly, as an agency, to your client, and you as the marketer in a brand, how do you stand firm to whoever you report to go, let's stand firm and keep and maintain our position and maintain this campaign? Because that's sometimes your point, how sometimes campaigns change in the middle of things without measuring it. How do you stand firm when it looks like there's a new trend that's changing the scene?
I think that the work that Byron Sharp has done with How Brands Grow around mental availability and physical availability is interesting, because what he says is, you know, mental availability is obviously important, but whoever has the greatest physical availability will win in terms of distribution. You know, so something like Prime comes along, and I think it's a very good example, because I think that not enough brands and agencies spend enough time really reading the room. I think they can get quite stuck in their own world, and I think they can sort of miss things that are coming down the line competitively. And in some instances, the competitor is not even from your category. It's not, you know what I mean? I mean, so I think it's a very good example to constantly be kind of listening and watching and observing. And then I think to really take competition seriously, I think you must. I mean, he may not have had, you know, Prime may not have had physical availability per se in terms of distribution, but they had an incredible reach in the audience.
Yeah.
But then it was also kind of, let's see how this will play out. It was incredibly faddish.
Hmm.
And it was quite expensive. And in the beginning, the scarcity aspect of it made it more faddish.
Yes.
And ultimately, when people tasted it, they didn't particularly like it. So, you know, I know with my kids, I managed to get them some prime. Oh, my God, I was the best mother in the world. They never asked for another one.
Yeah.
Do you know, they never asked for another. They didn't like it. So, but I guess, you know, the Coca-Colas of the world were lucky that they didn't like it, because otherwise they would have had a serious competitor on their hands. But yeah. I think how do you stand firm? You stand by the brand that you've got. You stand by your brand voice, but you also can be tactical. You can be playful.
Mm.
And I think not enough brands are playful with their voice.
Yeah.
You can challenge it. And I think you've got to put some money into some research, like actually figure out, do people like this stuff, you know? And then look at your innovation. Like, why was that thing interesting? You know, Coca-Cola's got this incredible, incredible campaign. And I can't even remember what it's called. It's called Imagination Factory or something like that. And they come up now with these unbelievably scarce, designed, curated drops, following on what's happened with, you know, the sneaker world or with something like Prime, where it is this mad, and then they do these things and it's available for a short term only, and they've been incredibly successful for the business of Coca-Cola.
Yes.
Because it's made it more than just an old legacy brand that's been around for however many years and comes along at Christmas. It's actually unbelievably on trend with these kind of mini drops. So I think it's a lovely way of taking this thing that you've got, breaking it, playing with it, experimenting with it, but remaining true to what you are.
If you're enjoying The Lead Creative, please share this episode with your network and hit follow or subscribe. Enjoy the show.
So you consult with marketers and agencies, and on both sides, you kind of see what, I feel like you kind of get breadcrumbs and insights into what leads to effective work on both sides, or what, you know, what pitfalls there are on both sides to having effective work. What is it that both sides should understand about each other and about their environments to create more effective work, or work that kind of ticks the boxes of effectiveness and brand resilience at the same time without it being too short term?
I think they need to understand that they're on the same team. One of my best clients ever, a lady called Gail Clintworth, she was a CMO of Unilever. And we were having a bit of a wrangle about a creative script that she felt we were pushing a bit far in some areas. And she actually said to me she found it weird that she had to buy the work. Mm. You know, that we were selling it and she had to buy it. She said, you know, we're actually making this thing together. And she's 100% right. And they, you know, one of the charts I've got in one of my presentations to clients is their brief is the first part of the creative process. It's not relay, it's rugby. So you're not handing it over, saying, here at the other end. You're saying, here's this thing, and it then is going to go there, and it's going to go there, and it might come back to you, and it might go to someone else, and it's a fluid process. And I think very often there's this misunderstanding that it's us and them. It's not. It's one team co-creating a piece of work. So that, I think, is super important. Understanding the roles and responsibilities in that space, who gets to make a decision. You know, one of my creative directors I used to work with said he would present work to a client and she would always pick up a red pen when she wanted to, And he would say, why are you picking up a red pen? We're just looking at it. But she would immediately want to go into like, oh, I want to change that and I want the headline different. Yeah. I want this blue. So it's understanding how to evaluate. And then I think the biggest part, if I look at all the Effie case studies and all of the stuff that comes through from award-winning cases, I think there are a number of things that stand out. One of them is most effective work is based on a strong insight. And we can say, insights, you know, we do get a bit hung up on insights, but it's insightful. Something that is insightful about the consumer and the way that the brand and category, that they interact with the brand and category. So insightful, an insightful angle into the thing is important. But also challenging the category norms. So much of what we see, and I was reading something yesterday with by Adam Morgan on the extraordinary cost of dull. So much of what we see is the same.
Yeah.
If it's, we actually did a video compilation of we made kind of one ad, but out of all of the different banks' ads. Mm-hmm. And we just took pieces from each bank and we put them. It was seamless. It looked like one bank because they were all saying the same thing. They were all using the same kind of methodology to deliver them their message. So one of the things in effectiveness is what are the category norms, what are the stereotypes, and how to avoid them because then you get noticed.
Yeah. You become different.
And if you're a strong brand, you've got to know how you can break it, how you can play with it, but stay true to your brand, but stand out. People are bombarded with messages. I think we're bombarded. I think somebody said that it was a study done, I think, by Harvard, and they said we're exposed to between 3,000 and 5,000 messages every 24 hours. So how is your little ad going to fare in that mess? And that's excluding the competition with TikTok, Netflix, everything else that our consumers are being, you know, bombarded with. How are you going to break through?
Yeah, that's very interesting. You also are in rooms where a lot of big decisions are made, you know, marketing, advertising decisions, who to go with and kind of how to show up, as you've just put it. What's something that you are rethinking or unlearning about marketing and advertising at the moment?
I think that Byron Sharp's book, How Brands Grow, it gave me a headache when I read it because it takes everything that you think you know about marketing, turns it on its head. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I didn't agree with all of it. Mm. And it's been, you know, it's been challenged and discussed to death. I think it's very, very useful.
Yeah.
One of the big sort of issues, and him and Mark Ritson have had this argument for years. One of the big areas was around differentiation and distinctiveness. And he felt that brands did not need differentiation and that consumers don't buy on differentiation. That was extremely hard for me to get my head around because I don't agree.
Okay.
I think it's category specific. But I still believe that I think what I've learned from him is that distinctiveness is as important as differentiation. And he's come out and said, I didn't say that brands don't need differentiation. I kind of think he did. But anyway, but distinctiveness has become more important in a way in that I think what I've learned is, you know, the whole the mental availability, having your distinctive assets. And so what distinctive assets allow you to do, so for example, Coca-Cola's, you know, a scripty hand, you know, a logo thing or the shape of their bottle or, you know, whatever those distinctive assets are that you own, a color, a shape, whatever, is Margaretson calls them codes, is that you then can play with them. You can be playful with them. And we've seen, you know, Kellogg's has done something. They're all sort of doing the same thing now.
Yeah.
You know, breaking up their logo and showing it in different spaces. But Pepsi's done it and Kellogg's has done it and a few others. But so for me, differentiation as a strategist, I would have thought and I still believe is extremely important. Mm. What do you do differently? Why should someone choose you over your competitor? You've got to have a point of difference, even if it is emotional point of difference. There has to be a point of difference. But alongside that, there needs to be very strong distinctiveness. So how you show up on the shelf is Nivea does it so well. It's blue. You pick it up. You know. So that's something that I really had to kind of explore and go through that book and go, is this true? Is this true for me? Is it true what I've seen? I know they've got data for it, but, you know, and then the ensuing discussion over the last 15 years or whatever has been really interesting. I think another one is just the power of digital to build a brand. I think that was a perception that you can't build a brand in digital. I think you absolutely can. I think that there was a whole phase where people were saying they were consumer-centric. Companies were going, we're consumer-centric, and they absolutely weren't. A phrase I really dislike intently is a phrase and a philosophy is digitally led or mobile first. They make me want to vomit because it should be people first, customer first. You know. And then you have all these digitally led people. You know, that everything is on an app.
Yeah.
But it's not functional. You know, like I don't mind. I love apps. I've got 9 million apps on my phone. Mm. But then make it work. And then you phone them because the app's not working. And then they're going to charge you for the call. But you're only phoning them because the app's not.
I think there's a big customer experience piece I was about to say, and I think I mean we spoke about Prime a bit earlier, and I want to just go back to that alongside a different brand because of the distinctiveness and differentiation piece that you've just mentioned, because a lot of it is yes, you can be you can have that distinctiveness and differentiation, but the proof is always in the pudding. And with Prime, that, you know, that proof in the pudding wasn't quite there. But I think about a brand like Red Bull, just by itself in the market, the way it tastes, it's not the best tasting thing. And I think there's, you know, there are many debates from Rory Sutherland saying you had to taste different to kind of stand out. But I think where Red Bull has something that Prime didn't is that differentiation, I suppose, and that distinctiveness, which then led to this mental availability that you also talk about. How do you kind of, if you are a brand like in this example, Prime, where the proof in the pudding doesn't really cut it, how do you then drive differentiation, distinctiveness, and build an audience, even at the back of that, by doing so deliberately in the way that Red Bull did?
Yeah, and I mean it's hard because you know, Red Bull is, I don't know, 80 years old or something. You know, they've been doing this for a very long time, and it's a great example of a brand who defined a positioning by accident, by the way. It was not what they set out to do. So I think that's an interesting lesson, is sometimes your brand gets taken to places that you didn't intend, but it's fulfilling a consumer need. And if you listen to that carefully enough, you can go there. And that's what Red Bull did. But the other interesting thing about Red Bull, and it is an interesting comparison to Prime, because they actually weirdly define themselves as a media company. And they have a content production team that is hundreds of people. And they've been doing this for a very long time. So everyone, content was a whole new thing, you know, 10 years ago. Red Bull's been doing this for ages. So, you know, they've got, and it's all around their core positioning and differentiator around energy and whatever. So they're an amazing brand to study. But so my one point is it's difficult for a prime to compete with a brand that's been at it for a bazillion years. But we also know that those brands don't always survive.
Yeah.
If they don't stay current. So a brilliant example, I think, is Liquid Death in the UK.
The canned water.
The canned water. So, you know, they're a brilliant example on so many levels because they came in to a very well-established, very conservative category, actually. I mean, who was being playful with water? No one. Everyone was talking about it came from the fjords and the streams and it was so pure and it was, you know, blah, blah, which we all loved at the time. But then no one has been playful with water and along comes Liquid Death. It looks like a beer. It's got this crazy name. It's got these unbelievably, like, insane graphics on the can. Who's going to drink water out of a can? No one. Well, turns out everyone. And I think it was just a beautiful example of looking at a category that's actually become quite boring and everything looks the same and going, how do we break in here? I don't know. Look, maybe it was just unlucky. I don't know. I don't think they really did the marketing stuff properly.
Yeah.
I think they thought it was a great idea and they had this reach and they threw some designs at it and it took off immediately. I don't think they thought through the pricing. I don't think they thought through the taste. I don't know. I might not be right. But, yeah, I think a degree of luck sometimes is involved, you know?
Yeah. And I think, I some of the talk has always been that it wasn't built off the back of strong marketing fundamentals, like the boring stuff and foundation. It was built on the shiny things of marketing, like influence, like all of these kinds of things. So Gillian, we have a pass the mic question that our guest leaves for our next guest. And one of our previous guests was Donald Mukhale, the MD of Moya App and director of Hebraism. And the question he left for you was, what impact on business do you think an understanding of culture and culture in the context of consumers, what impact do you think an understanding of culture might have on business? In this case, I guess, marketing and effectiveness. How much does culture contribute to that, to business or understanding it or being embedded in it?
I think culture for me is one of those words that where marketers sometimes lose their internal audience, because I don't think that a lot of people actually kind of know what it is.
Yeah.
I would say that culture for me is the importance of staying current and it's important of understanding your audience. And then understanding why that matters and how to play with it, where you can actually make that work for you. So, you know, a lot of people, and I think it's been particularly true with kind of the influencer movement where there's kind of culture bandwagon jumping that happens, where something happens and then every brand is jumping on it to be part of culture.
Yes.
But it doesn't always fit and it's not relevant for every brand. So I would think understanding culture is a little bit like, you know, really understanding the world that your consumers are living in, what's driving them, what the trends are, you know, what the influences are, but then aligning that with where can your brand hop on and how does it need to and where can it make a difference? And there's some, you know, there's some brands that do it brilliantly. But I read a presentation the other day about by a content strategist, and he was just saying, you know, don't go chasing after every piece of culture. Find the pieces of culture that really fit. Yeah. And I think then you can make a huge impact. But I think it also depends. Sometimes it's extremely short term. And then sometimes it's quite self-serving, and sometimes it's actually damaging. So it's an interesting one. It's an interesting one. I think the impact, if you get it right, can be enormous, because it can entrench your brand point of view and your brand voice in a way that's relevant. And I think relevance is the big issue. But it's so hard to get it wrong.
Gillian, thank you so much for making the time. I think, yeah, I think the big takeaways from that is, I suppose, partly I feel like authenticity and consistency is what drives effectiveness. And at times we are too caught up on the hype and the trend to stay true to ourselves and stay true to our brands in order to see that growth. And sometimes we want that growth to happen too quickly without moving and shifting the levers sufficiently enough to stay, I suppose, relevant at all times. And relevance is one of those hardest things, as you've just put it. Thank you so much for making time. That was a very insightful conversation.
Thanks, Mongezi. It's good to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to The Lead Creative. Did you get one insight that's worth sharing from this episode? Please share it with your network or your friends. Pop me some of your ideas and innovative finds on Twitter on @Mongezi. This podcast is available on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple, Google, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find me on mongezi.com.